Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to this special edition of ScaryCast. I'm Dr. John Stamey, and we've got a heck of a good program for everybody tonight. Our guest is live from the West Coast right now, Mr. Marshall Masters, author, entrepreneur, adventurer, and a lot of other great words, great adjectives that can describe him. Marshall, how are you doing tonight? And thank you for being with us.
Oh, pleasure to be on. Doing just fine. As always, busy, 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 busy.
I understand.
But then I like it that way.
Well, I do too. So we're both workaholics, but that's kind of a good thing. It really is. So I wanted to thank you very much for being here on this special edition of ScaryCast. Last week, I announced that we were talking about Nibiru and the Anunnaki, and you said, well, you know, John, I've got a book. And I said, well, then, if you got a book and you like talking about it as much as I do, let's do a special show, and you and I can just talk about that for an hour and a half. And you were amenable to it. I'm glad you were, and scheduled it for the time we're on right now. It'll, of course, go into circulation on iTunes, Spotify, and the other networks. So just glad to have you. Now, let's jump right in and start talking about our topic. Where do you want to start talking about it? Because they're all closely related, the Anunnaki, the Nephilim, Nibiru, Planet X, the Sumerians. I was just watching, in fact, a little video on the Sumerians, and they made a really, really neat point. They said, for a civilization that has given our world so much technology, so many advancements, why don't we study this in junior high and high school? Why don't you try to answer that question as we get along, Marshall?
Well, I love the question, and I'll tell you why. The thing about it is that when you're talking about the Anunnaki, you really wind up having to have a conversation about Zachariah Sitchin, who wrote The 12th Planet and a whole series of books. And Zachariah Sitchin was interesting. He was in a yeshiva, actually training to become a rabbi. And he saw things in the Bible that just didn't add up, and he started asking questions. And, you know, it's I always get a kick out of asking people how many churches or synagogues or study groups you've been kicked out of. And if they start laughing, I know they're my kind of people. And Sitchin was, he was asking questions that were, quite frankly, very challenging for dogma and doctrine. As in, well, just who are we anyway? And I think of all of the books Sitchin has written, the one I would start with is The Lost Book of Enki. This is an autobiography written by a scribe who is dictation from Lord Enki. There were two brothers, Enki and Enlil. Now, Enlil is, he doesn't like us much. As a point, in fact, he's tried twice to wipe humanity out completely. First time with the flood, and second time with nuclear attack. And never managed to do it. We went on. Enlil, just a gnarly guy. Now, Enki, we were created. And what happened was the Anunnaki, when their planet Nibiru comes through the core of our system, it really tears up their atmosphere. And in order to repair the atmosphere, they use gold. And the gold is it serves the same purpose essentially as the aluminum that's used in the chemtrail sprays that they're hitting us with. And it's for repairing the atmosphere. What happened was that they needed to breed gold miners. So what they did after a lot of experiment, it was like the island of Dr. Moreau, what they were doing. It was pretty ugly, actually. And then they finally got around to capturing some early hominids, our early ancestors, and they crossbred them with Anunnaki genes and set certain limitations. But that's the reason why we go gaga for gold. There are other metals that are actually more precious than gold. And there's other metals which are arguably more useful, like silver. But it, you know, in an industrial sense, but gold is what we were bred to mine. So that's the reason why you flash a gold coin in front of us, we go gaga. And as the story goes in the Lost Book of Enki, this is translated from the Sumerian texts by Sitchin, was that they had made fairly good success with breeding, and Lord Enki was walking along a riverbank, and he saw two of the girls that had come out of the breeding, you know, out of the breeding program, and he was rather taken with them, and he bore children with them, and that is how we came to be. So we essentially come from the loins of an extraterrestrial, which means we're all extraterrestrials. And for any institution that covets its dogma and doctrine, this is not the narrative they want to hear. And so that's the reason why there's so much suppression and antagonism, because when you look to see it, it really comes from the fundamentalists of various faiths who just despise Sitchin for opening up for them what is a can of worms. And there's a lot that controls it. I mean, to give you an example, I did a lot of work on researching the Mayans in the lead up to 2012. And one of the things that's really difficult for archaeologists with the Mayans is dating, because for over 100 years, the Catholic Church made it known to archaeologists, if you predate anything about the Mayans before the birth of Yeshua, your career is going to be destroyed. All kinds of evil stuff's going to fall on top of you. So you don't have accurate dating on the Mayans. There's that kind of contention that takes us away from just a pure science view of it. And it's just the way it is. So the same kind of meddling that was Mayan archaeologists were getting so long, the same thing has been thrown at those that follow the work of Zachariah Sitchin and talking about the Anunnaki. Now, I have a book that I wrote called Being in It for the Species, and this really talks extensively about what will happen when the Anunnaki return. They're going to be coming for two things specifically. One is gold to repair their atmosphere, and the other is that they're going to want young women for slave breeding programs. And apparently slaves, if they're carried naturally, are for some reason seem to perform better than the ones that are tank grown. And they'll use these women, and then when they're finished with them, they'll be returned. And the book was something that was worked with a team, and had one fellow who was doing the science tracking on it, and I had a psychic, and very, very good psychic, very well renowned. she worked a lot on this with us, and also I did my own channeling, and where I was working with my guides to tap into the Akashic record. And the book is written in three parts. First part is, this is what's going to happen. It's not terribly pretty. And we're starting to see the beginning of that. The other thing is, then the second part is, what can we do as communities or as nations? And then the third part is, what can we do as individuals? So two-thirds of the book is really on the upside tone, really about how do we deal with this? Because when the Anunnaki arrive in these city ships that are massive, we're really going to be freaked out. And folks are not being prepared for it. So that was the point of writing Being in It for the Species, is to help people kind of get their heads wrapped around this. And so that when the Anunnaki do return, they can be sober about it and not be totally intimidated, but not go off the deep end and start acting like idiots either. This is going to happen, and we will see them. We'll see the Anunnaki come. They're going to take what they want. And then just before things really start going sideways, they'll leave. So they're not going to stay because they're, you know, they're passing through the system. Like I said, women and gold. That's it. That's what they want. And
so
we'll do.
Are you saying that when Nibiru and that whole constellation system comes flying around the sun here, maybe in 3 or 4 years, that's when they're going to drop in and pay us a visit?
Yeah, it'll be after the Nemesis reaches perihelion, which is its point, closest point to the sun. And that's about when they're going to show up, and they'll be here, do whatever they're going to do, and then they're going to leave. And I have to be honest, you know, I look at a lot of everything that's going on right now, John, and I'm very, very encouraged about how we're going to handle it, because what it really boils down to is our freedom. That's what it really comes down to, is freedom. And for the longest time, over a decade, I was really almost feeling no hope at all, because what I was seeing is that we have become so dumbed down, so passive, so controlled, that when these guys show up, that's all. We're just going to roll over like mullets and take whatever it is that they're going to dish out. And now I look and see what's happening with Yellow Jackets in France, Brexit in England, MAGA here in the United States. This is a global sociological event. This is huge. This is absolutely huge. People are saying, we want our freedom back. And they're tired of the way that the elites have, the globalist elites, have really gutted everybody's lives. And if you look at what they've done, it's just really awful, because we keep hearing the statistic that half of the people in America do not have $1,000 in savings. 60, and there's a lot of them that just simply couldn't write a check for more than $400 at any one time. And so people are living hand to mouth, and that's the majority of Americans are living hand to mouth. And this is a result of the elites. And there was something that was mentioned to me a year ago, and when the fellow said it, it was so natural. You just didn't. It was an observation, and I take quite a lot of interest when people say something profound, and it just flows right out of their lips. They don't know what. I wouldn't say they don't know. It just comes naturally. They get a thought in their head, and it just pops right out. And a lot of times, that's really, really important information. That's unfiltered. That's not where they've gone through some rational process to try and chew it up, make it palatable. And this one fellow just said, I look at everything that's going on with politics, and it makes me think that there are competing Anunnaki bloodlines. And the goal is whoever's running the show when the Anunnaki arrive will continue to rule the show after they leave. And that their positions will be firmed up that way. So you look at what's going on right now between the globalists and the anti-globalists, and if we thought about it as competing bloodlines that are working through minions and supporters. So these are people not necessarily in the bloodline, but working with it and associated with it and finding that their interests parallel those of the bloodline. And for the last year, that has been on my mind. And also, long before, I'm sure your listeners heard of QAnon, and I knew about all this stuff that was going on politically many, many months before Q ever showed up. Back then, it was the Alliance and White Hats and the Black Hats.
If you would, please, Marshall, some folks might not be familiar with QAnon. Can you give a quick primer on that, please?
Yeah. Well, what's happening right now is, this is my analysis of it based on what I've seen and following all the information, is that when we look and see what's going on on television, it's kabuki theater. That's all. It's all just kabuki theater. What's really going on is we have a huge battle. The elites, the globalists, have been running the show for decades with central banks, pedophile rings, and so forth. And they're ingratiated into every aspect of government. So it's not something where Andrew Jackson stood up to him, and it was easy for him to defeat them because it was a different time. Not so now. I would venture to say that if you look at MAGA, everything that's going on in that direction, this is orchestrated by the military, because all of the tactics are strategic tactics. It's not political tactics the way this stuff handles. Like, take, for example, right now, everyone thinks, well, Trump got his ass kicked. All right. Nancy really whooped him a good one because he caved in and he reopened the government for 3 weeks. That politically, that's how it plays. But if you are thinking strategically in a military sense, it's a strategic retreat so that you can pick the killing field. You take that away from your adversary. You choose the battleground, not them. So he pulled back, tactical retreat. What does he get out of it? First off, he gets his State of the Union, which is really powerful because it's the only way he's going to get his message out beyond all of the manipulation of the media. And I can say that, back in the 80s, when I was a producer with CNN, it was a very different company back then. Now I look at it and it's this ugly invasion of the body snatchers. But that's the case for most of the media right now. Is it just it's ugly, and we're seeing more and more evidence of it. Now look what happened with this BuzzFeed fiasco and things like that. Well, Trump gets his presentation before Congress to do the State of the Union now. They just set that. He also has Nancy and Chuck in a box, because when the government was shut down, they kept saying, reopen the government, and then we'll talk about the wall, which was a big step up from we'll never talk about the wall. So now Trump, for 3 weeks, has taken himself out of the limelight, and the light is on Congress, particularly Nancy and Chuck. They're going to have to be able to demonstrate that they can work some sort of compromise to make it happen. If they don't, then it's going to look bad on them. And it's going to give Trump a true crisis to step in and say, look, I gave you 3 weeks. You blew it. You couldn't do something. You're blocking all the efforts. Now I got to do what I got to do. So this is, as you can see, it's purely military. It's tactical. Now, just like you're out in the field and you retreat from a battle zone area so that you draw the enemy into a killing zone. And they think that they're beating you when all you're doing is retreating so you can take the initiative and control the battle. And that's all that's really going on here. So, it just keeps buzzing around in my head, John. Now, divergence in a different Anunnaki bloodlines fighting to see who's going to be the big cheese when the great Flabaz from the sky shows up in his mile-wide city ship. And it's an interesting point for folks for the women that are going to be abducted by the Anunnaki. My heart goes out to them. My heart goes out to them, because they're just going to be used like cattle. They'll be returned afterwards, but many of them will be permanently devastated for life, because they will have carried a child, and then that child will be have been removed from them, and they're always going to have that loss of connection to deal with, being abused, being used that way, although in the book I do write that they will be treated fairly well. The Anunnaki will view them somewhat as indentured servants, and that's about how they'll handle it. So all of this, it starts unfolding, John, if people are going to be just stunned and shocked. And the fact that I'm seeing so many people right now going, give us back our freedom. They're standing up and they're confronting the elites. That fills me with hope for the future. Fills me with hope. It doesn't mean, when I'm saying fill me with hope, it doesn't mean that we're going to have an easy time of it. We're not. But there's an old expression, winners never quit and quitters never win. We're not going to be a bunch of quitters. And that to me is good news.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, one thing you're talking about Trump and versus the Democrats. Right now, the Democrats aren't saying one word about the wall or anything. It's just business. It's back business as usual for them. So they're not focused like one should be. They're focusing on other things. And I think it's going to be interesting in 3 weeks what happens. I think it will be, because he's got them in a box now. And if they don't do anything, well, it's not going to be good. But anyway, I wanted to get back to our topic tonight, which I find quite fascinating. you got the Anunnaki, and if you could just give us a brief rundown of the Nephilim, because I've got, once you tell us a little bit about the history of the Nephilim, I've got a question for you. Okay?
Well, I just really, the Nephilim, I didn't get into that so much as I just really focused on the Anunnaki, and because these are the ones we're just going to have to deal with. Nephilim really comes, this is more along those that are following biblical lines on this. And that's not the line that I follow on it. The Nephilim are, like, a good example is Marzulli. You know, he's very heavy on the Nephilim. And they go and they talk quite a bit about that. But for me, it's just the Anunnaki, because when that is very well documented, Sitchin has written about it extensively in several books, and it's not something that is subject to a lot of interpretation. With Sitchin's work, you either like it or you don't. There's just no other way to look at it. People are for it or they're against it. And it really comes from your own personal background. So I would have to defer to somebody like Lynn Marzulli. He really does the Nephilim heavily.
Okay, well that's fine. So anyway, getting back to the Anunnaki, I think that their story is extremely interesting, and it all really revolved around Sumeria, correct?
That's right. Sumer was the first civilization. Now, it's an amazing thing. We're just hunter-gatherers running around with clubs and spears. And next thing you know, we're inventing language, building cities, just language, all kinds of things. And nobody has really been able to explain how is it that all of a sudden the Sumerians pop up with all of this, all these amazing advances, all this stuff that they can do, and no one can figure out how to connect the dots. But yet it's really, really simple. We were gifted the technology. We have the Anunnaki genes. We have our hominid genes. And we get good and bad from both sides. I tend to focus on the good. Now, the Anunnaki are builders. They tend to be arrogant. They can be very violent. But these are very. This is a very determined race. The hominids remind me of your aboriginals, like in Australia, or your Americans. And these are folks that are very much tied to the land, very spiritual in their concept. What we got from the Anunnaki was basically our left brain with all of our engineering skills, technical skills, logical skills. But on the right side, the artistic side, this comes from our hominid ancestors. And this doesn't trouble me that we have this mixture, because in the final analysis, everything comes from God. So it's all good. It doesn't matter how you got it, who you got it from. You got it, you got it. That's it. Possession is 9/10 of the deal. And so, for example, one of the things that comes up with psychics is our ability to telepathically communicate. And we have really done a lot to suppress this. We have natural abilities that we tend to suppress. we can do this. Very good psychics are telepathic, and they can go vast distances. They can go as far as the other side of the galaxy, which there are other species that are more advanced than us, and their powers are nowhere near as strong. They can be within a solar system, but not much further. Whereas we can communicate with people on the other side of the galaxy. And I remember one time I was working, this one gal was extremely talented, one of my best psychics. And this was when we were doing a very systematic analysis. It was, I had a three-person team. One person on the team, Janice, her job was to give me cross-reference questions. So I would ask a question early in a channeling session, and then I would come back and ask it a different way later on, like an attorney does in cross-examination. Then
hey, Marshall, if you can hold that thought, we're gonna pay a couple of bills. We'll be back in 2 minutes with more Marshall Masters, the Anunnaki, and what's going on with Planet X and Nibiru. So, Marshall, we'll see you in 2 minutes.
Okay.
Scarycast will return in 45 seconds. We are back with more Scarycast featuring Marshall Masters. Marshall, so please continue that thought. It was very interesting. Marshall, are you there?
Excuse me. I turned off my microphone. Nope. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Can you hear me?
I have technical. Oh, perfectly. I have some tech problems too. So continue your story, sir. It was really getting good.
Well, the thing here is that we were working, and the interesting thing was we had multiple psychics that we worked with. And once I started this study, I wasn't looking for them. They just would show up, and I'd get an email, and somebody would just say, gee, you know, do you need somebody to help you with this? And the other side was literally helping us to get into this. And what we did was we worked with numerous psychics. What we found, the best ones were women in their 40s and their 50s, in solid marriages with good husbands who respected their wives' ability to work psychically, as opposed to denier spouses who mock and humiliate their loved ones because they have this ability. And these gals could do amazing things. Some of them would work with multiple entities. Others would work with just one or two. There were three types of entities that we dealt with in our study, incarnated, unincarnated, and extraterrestrial. and incarnated and unincarnated, which is just simply incarnated was a classification for those who had incarnated in a previous life as a human on our planet. And then unincarnated were the ones that had never been in human form on our planet. And of course, the ETs. And all three very different in their point of view. The incarnated were tactical and very much in tune with what we were feeling and seeing, whereas the unincarnated are more at the 10,000 foot level. They're seeing things in a broad scale. They see the big picture, the strategic view. And then there's the ETs. The ETs that we were connecting with, we didn't have a way to vet them. With incarnated and unincarnated entities, it was very easy to vet them. What I would always do is at the end of a session, I would ask the entity, what we did was I was the one interviewing the entity through the channeler, and my two teammates, their microphones were muted, and they were giving the instant message information. So from Yako, who is the science guy, I was getting science questions, and the cross-references were coming in from Janice. And I would keep the conversation going, and what we always found was that we could do cross-examination. They didn't object to it, and they always came out right on the money. But the real tell was when I would close a session, I would say, give me a weather event 6 to 12 months out that's easily recognizable. And because what we learned with the entities is it's really impossible for them to understand what's happening beneath the surface of the planet. But they can see what's happening in the atmosphere just as clearly as we can. And they can move backwards and forwards in time. And so they would give us an event, and every time, dead on the money. There was one, for example, the guide said, you're going to have a typhoon that's coming in off the Pacific, heading towards Baja, Mexico. It is then going to deviate and turn towards San Diego. It will either make landfall as a typhoon or as a heavy wind. And sure enough, we monitored. We kept that stuff. You know, Yako was the one who was tracking that, but so was I. Boom. I mean, it happened exactly when he said it was going to happen. You know, came in towards Baja, turned towards San Diego, and it hit San Diego as a tropical wind and as a tropical storm. So we always could get verification. That was really, really excellent. I get verification when I do channeling. Interestingly enough, it's in the language. Entities will use words that I'm remotely familiar with, vaguely I've heard them, but, you know, like erudite and things like that. It's not in my normal lexicon. After the reading, I will go and I'll look up the words, and it was in every time, absolutely the perfect words. So it's not a word that I knew the real definition of. It wasn't something that was in my lexicon, but when the guides use it, they nail it dead on the money, just dead on the money. So this one gal that we were working with, she was one of the best, and we were kind of burning through them because we were asking questions about the flyby, what they were seeing. And the things that they were seeing in the future were so mortifying for them that it really affected them, and they would come to a burnout, and it was hard for them to just say say to me, gee, you know, I'm seeing these awful things in my mind when I'm doing the channeling, because she not only hears or he hears, but they're seeing as well. And the things that they were seeing were just horrible, just horrible. And they would burn out. And so what I would do is when I saw that happening, I'd let them go and just say, thank you. You know, just move on, put it behind you. Don't dwell on it. You know, you need to sleep at night. But this one gal, we were working with an ET, and the extraterrestrials that we were talking to in our work. And again, I mean, we had a protocol for this. You know, this wasn't sitting around with Mama Yablonsky and her crystal ball nonsense. This is something where we took a very structured scientific approach to it. And so I'm talking with this one entity, extraterrestrial, and this ET is on the opposite side of the galaxy, okay? It's like, forget it, you know? It reminds me of an old cartoon from Mad Magazine. You know, Billy Mummy goes, hey, Dad, how much further do we got to go? And he says, about 100 light years. And he says, Dad, I don't think I can hold it that long. And so they're on the other side of the galaxy. And as we are wrapping up, I just, you know, people think that you talk to them in some sort of special way. You know, like, what doest thou thinkest? And that kind of exaggerated nonsense. No, you talk to them just like I'm talking to you. And
just like
here's
you and
something
I'm talking, yeah.
You. That's right. And you know what? The other side, they laugh at fart jokes. They have a sense of humor. So, it's people think it has to be harps and thunder and all that. No, there's no difference between when we're here or we're the other side of the veil, we're still who we are. All right. And
yeah,
so I'm working with this, and the typical answer, the typical thing we used to get all the time from the ETs, it was like a drumbeat. It was consistent, was they kept saying, please don't make the mistake that we did. Don't go expedient. Take the high road. And it really reminds me of the Hopi prophecy rock, where if we take the high road, we're going to have a beautiful future. We're going to have a Star Trek future. And if we just keep doing what we're doing because it's expedient, we're going to be a slave species for countless generations to come until the planet's not worth raping anymore. And then we'll be left to be the masters of a dying world. And so I asked this entity, this ET, final question. I said, I appreciate all the information that you've given us, everything you've expressed and shared. Now I got one question for you. You're on the other side of the galaxy. Why do you care about what happens to us? What's in it for you? What's your angle? I asked the question just that way. The answer I got back, John, just absolutely my jaw hit the floor. And what the ET came back and said, how do you think you're at 7 billion souls on your planet? Earth only has 2 billion native souls. The other 5 billion are from everywhere else in the galaxy. We're interested in you because you've got our ancestors. And
wow, that's something else.
Isn't it? And,
yeah.
You know, the question is, why do we have all of these, you know, why do we have all of these souls from other worlds incarnating here? And that was the quest that that particular conversation put me on. And
well, did you get an answer for that?
I have an answer for that. And
okay.
This is something that it'll be in my next book, Perpetual Genesis. And but essentially, what's really going to happen is, you know, there's just one. If we lose the power grid, all we have to do is lose the power grid. Catastrophic failure. That happens. Our own government has already estimated that 9 out of 10 Americans die just from that one causality. That's it. Because we don't know how to live without electricity. All right. And the net result is going to be, we're going to have, when things go sideways, we're going to have a massive amount of death. A massive amount of death. And this is going to affect those who survive. I find it a little curious in the sense that when, like, we're looking here with what's happening with MAGA, Make America Great Again, the Red Hats. And if you just look at it topographically, geologically, where are the Red Hats? They're in the middle of the country, where the greatest number of survivable regions for what's coming are located. And where are the liberals and the globalists? They live along the coastlines, which are a bone to be chewed. If you live in New York, you live in Los Angeles, or you live in Myrtle Beach, how long can you tread water? You're going to drown. And so it makes me wonder sometimes if, you know, what's really been happening with globalism, and I mean, globalism is easy to define, that it's just a reallocation of poverty. They went over, took poverty from Chinese families, exported it to American families in the mid of the country. That creates a displacement of wealth, which the elites and the globalists can then skim right off the top like cream. That's it. That's how simple it is. It's, you know, reallocation of poverty so they can create wealth displacement and skim the wealth and use it whatever they want to use it. So I look at the Red Hats and I'm going, you know, think about it. These folks are really tough. They've had a couple of decades now of watching their jobs go overseas, watching their towns die, watching their savings go, watching all of this stuff that for the globalists and for their sycophants who have not been hurt by this. Or globalism has helped a lot of people, and it's hurt a lot of people, and it's just the haves don't want to hear from the have-nots. You know, it's like, you know, they want to feel good about themselves taking benefits from someone else's misery. And so the people in the middle of the country, the Red Hats, they're used to this. They're used to being stepped on. They're used to being mocked, humiliated, belittled, treated like garbage, watching their children go and fight in these ridiculous, unwinnable foreign wars for the globalists and their industrials. Then having to deal with, you know, what do you do when your kid comes home missing arms and legs? That's an impact on the whole family. And so there's been decades of quiet suffering. And these are the folks that put Trump into office. They finally found a voice. These people have been prepared for hardship. They have been prepared for hardship for over two decades since the Clintons were in office. That's when all of this started going down. And it makes you wonder that if this isn't the hand of God in a way, because these are the folks that the folks that are standing up now and putting on the MAGA hats and saying, I want my freedom back, are the ones that pretty much are going to be most of the survivors. They're the ones that know how to hunt. They know how to garden. They know how to go out and, you know, figure out how to live off the land. These people do this, you know, where folks in the city is, you know, if it's nice to have a luxury condominium on a 20th floor, but when there's no more electricity, guess what? No more water. The toilets aren't going to flush. even if the toilets are going to flush, the sewage has got nowhere to go because there's no electricity to process it. And they're going to starve to death. And they're going to, it'll be absolutely dog eat dog. It'll be absolutely horrible. And then the red hats are going to be in a situation where they're going to be adapting much faster, doing much better. So I look at them and I say, you know, if someone's going to survive, yeah, let it be the red hats. Let it be the yellow jackets. Let it be the Brexits. Let it be the people, the common people who are standing up and saying, I want my freedom. Because that's what it's going to take. It's going to take that kind of stout-hearted resolve to do this. And when we were talking with all of the guides, working with them, we were told about these things that were happening, what was coming on. I was told, you know, the book of humanity is, there was this one time, it was, and this for me was transformational. And I was really depressed because this was, well, I think in 2006, 2007, and I really came to understand what Agenda 21 really meant and all of these plans that the elites have. They want us to die like rats because they know we breed. So when they come up from their bunkers after things have cleared up, they'll just take over. And then they'll say, here's food. Go breed. We'll breed. We'll be enslaved, and they'll be happy. But that's not going to work out if you got a bunch of people that are wearing MAGA hats right now. If they're not going to knuckle down to the globalists now, they sure aren't going to do it after we reach the what I call the backside, when we see blue skies and taste sweet waters once again. That excites me. That makes me hopeful for the future. And I went for a whole decade just really, I didn't want to think about it because it was so depressing, seeing people give up their rights so easily, you know, because they're busier looking at their slavetronics than they are looking at what's happening in the world around them. And this is what the entities were telling us. It was Serapis Bay. And Serapis Bay was, in ancient times, was an Egyptian priest. And I was really, you know, looking at the Agenda 21 thing and really feeling like it was, you know, they were just going to win. And that was it. And humanity was going to lose. And Serapis Bay said, you know, Marshall, the story of humankind is a huge book, and it's not even half written. And
well, that's good.
Every book has many chapters. This book has chapters. And what Serapis Bay said, this chapter belongs to the elites. It's their chapter. And you're not going to take it away from them. So don't bother. And this was 10 years ago I was getting this. And but he said, and this is the real reason why I'm excited. Serapis Bay said, what the elites understand is that this is their chapter. But like all chapters and all books and all books, it will come to an end. And this is on the last few pages. And they understand that the next chapter does not belong to them, that it belongs to the good people, those who walk humbly with their God. And so just keep soldiering on. And when the time comes that they're going to try and trick you into allowing them to bluff their way from one chapter to the next, what you do is you just say no. When they start offering all of their inducements, all their great, glorious ideas, look, you, here's what we can do for you and all of that, all this expedient nonsense, you just say no. And if you say no, they fold up like a cheap tip, and humanity will win. We will have a Star Trek future. Future generations will be great. And I see now, here we are. We're probably on the last page of the current chapter of humanity. And you can almost bend the page back to see the next chapter. And it, that's why I'm so excited when I see this global social, sociological event that people are saying, I want my freedom. It's not something where they're going to be browbeaten and die in vast numbers, and you know, it'll be some sort of anger or resentment or some sort of negative emotion. No, they'll just stand their ground. They're, you know, think about those kids, that big fiasco that happened with the Native American yutz banging his tom-tom, and the media is saying, well, the boy wasn't doing anything, but the smile was insulting. Really? A smile is provoking? I mean, this, it just didn't pass the smell test with anybody.
Well, they had to say something, Marshall. They had to say something. They couldn't say nothing. So, I mean, that was the most nonsensical thing they could say, but that they had to have something to say.
Yeah.
I'll never forget
the comment.
They always got to
double down on stupid.
I know. I'll never forget the comment that one of the pundits made. That is just the kind of face you just want to punch. It's like, oh, you know, I mean, golly, how horrible is that? But anyway. Well, it's good
to
know.
It's a kid, for God's sake.
Hmm?
Yeah, it's like, you know, the funny thing is they sure, all these people that say this stuff and they have all this moral indignation, you know, I mean, probably the most animated is Don Lemon at CNN. You know, I bet that guy must spend 3 hours every morning putting on his I'm so insulted face and practicing the gestures and the movements, you know. And it's all I can say to Don is, remember what your mom said, you keep doing that, you'll go blind. But the, you know, and we have all of this idiocy and all this nonsense. But I am seeing the stout-hearted, and there is, see, in the Colburn Bible, which I published, all right?
Now, tell you what, before you get into the Colburn Bible, it's the top of the hour. We're going to take our two-minute break, and then we'll come back, and let's talk a little bit about the Colburn Bible, okay?
Look forward to it.
All right, we'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Dr. John, Scary Cast, and our guest is Marshall Masters. Scary Cast, we'll be back in 45 seconds. We are back with ScaryCast, having a wonderful discussion with Marshall Masters, Planet X Guru, and our next topic for our last third of our show is the Colburn Bible. So, Marshall, tell us about that. That is a very interesting book, document, and tell us kind of the story about it, and then and we'll proceed on.
Well, the Colburn Bible, and I have to be honest with you, when it was a fellow by the name of Steve Russell in Australia, who he was on my research team. Steve was, we were the ones working with the psychics. And he said, I have found this amazing book that just came out. It's 3,600 years old, and it's been released by the Culdeans in England, small religious sect. And it was down to maybe three or four. And there's a prophecy in the Colburn Bible that says literally it was perfect, dead on. It predicted the fall of the Soviet Union. It said, a country with the largest navy in the world will fall quickly like an apple rotten at the core. Well, a lot of people don't realize was that the Soviet Union, in terms of the actual number of ships, at the end of the Cold War, had the largest navy in the world. Ours has a lot of visual prominence because we base on carriers. Their strategy was missile cruisers and ballistic submarines, ballistic missile submarines. And this is how they were doing it. They had a third more ships than we did when they went down. And there were other things. Now, the Colburn is 11 books. 6 books are from the Egyptians, written about the time as the 5 books of Moses, which is in the Old Testament. And the other part is written by the other 5 chapters are written by the Celts. And this was about the same time as the New Testament was being written. And what happened was, the Colburn, it first came about as something the Egyptians called the Great Book, and it was like their 9/11 report. They were trying to figure out how Moses and this, you know, rascal of a Hebrew god kicked their pantheon of gods up and down the street and just gave them a good whooping. And they're trying to figure out, because their feeling was that the Hebrew God was a lesser God and they had the greater gods, and they couldn't figure out how this lesser God was so effective. So what they wanted to do was to find the greater God so that they could import that greater God of the Hebrews, if you will, into their pantheon. Well, it didn't work out for them, but they made a heck of an effort all throughout their trading realm. Their scribes and intellectuals, writers, during the day, you know, they would do normal business, count bricks, so to speak. But in the evenings, they would work with all of the learned men, the scholars, the religious people, the folks that knew the history and folklore of these regions they were trading in. And they were continually looking to find this greater God of the Hebrews. And they weren't able to do it, but the book itself actually was about the size of a modern printed encyclopedia. It was huge. And what happened was the Egyptians did a lot of business with the Phoenicians. And this was towards the close of the Bronze Age. And at that time, you need tin and copper to make bronze. And tin was hard to find. And what happened was that England was sitting on a mother load of tin. It literally was the Saudi Arabia of tin. And so the Phoenicians were trading And they had a big advantage. Their ships were very well made, but the Phoenicians could do something nobody else in Europe or the Mediterranean had ever done. They could navigate by the stars. Everybody else at that time had to navigate by following the coastlines, which is a very slow way to get wherever you're going. As opposed to, if you can follow the stars, then you could plot a course. Well, the Phoenicians, before they were completely destroyed by the Romans sacked them completely. That was it. They were in Lebanon, in what we now know as Lebanon. This is where the Phoenicians were based. And their trading realm extended from South Africa to Great Britain and all throughout the Mediterranean. And that is huge. They were taking the Celts in Great Britain were very fond of Egyptian papyrus for writing. And the Egyptians were also part of this process that was going on with the folklore. And the Phoenicians just fell in love with, because they could read the great book that was in the hieroglyphics of the Egyptians. And so what happened was the Phoenicians translated it using their own language. And a lot of people don't understand is that the Phoenician alphabet is 22 letters, and it is the foundation alphabet of our alphabet. Our alphabet came from the Phoenicians. So it wasn't a far leap to go. And they were translating a lot of this. And then they were trading in Great Britain, and the Celts really loved this stuff. And so they were studying from the Great Book, and which they came to call the Colbran. And the even when there was the Roman occupation, the Romans were having their children taught from the Colbran. And the what happened was when the Glastonbury Abbey, which actually had been built by Joseph of Arimathea, when that was sacked and burned, the Celtic priests took whatever they could of all the manuscripts of both the Celtic and the Egyptian, and they took those to a secret hiding place way north in Scotland, and it remained there for centuries. And eventually, there was a translation to the Old English, which was the style of Shakespeare. And then what happened was they brought it to London, and there they did the next translation where they put it into the Queen's English. And interestingly enough, during the Blitz, the entire manuscript of the Colbran was almost burned and destroyed, and not by Luftwaffe bombs, but there was a housewife who found it and thought it was a heretical document, it was heresy, and she was fixing to burn it in a fireplace. And they caught that, snatched it away from her, and then took it back up to Scotland. And after the fall of the Soviet Union, which was predicted in the Colbran, they knew it was time to release it and bring it to the world. I got my copy of the manuscript from a publisher in India, and he was really interested in it. But there is the 11th book, the Britain book, has the only biographical account of Jesus when he was alive in his time. And the ancient Celts at that time did not buy the trilogy. For them, Jesus was, they loved him passionately, every bit as much as Christians do today, but as a great wisdom teacher. And so that put it at odds with the doctrine and dogma of the church. So that was the reason why the abbey was burned. And but thankfully, these groups were able to take this information, secreted away again, and then they released it, and then I started publishing it. The Colburn Bible contains the most stunning accounts of Exodus and Noah's flood. And it's interesting how it parallels what's in the Bible, but the Egyptians add a lot more detail to it. There are differences in the story of Exodus in terms of, according to the Egyptians, the Pharaoh of Exodus was leading the charge when the sea rolled in and killed him. And the replacement, the Pharaoh, was actually a quieter, more studious guy. And after the Hebrews, the host, and actually there was a tremendous number of Egyptians that went with the Hebrews as well into the Sinai with Moses. And once, while they were out there in the Sinai, you know, scrabbling to stay alive, and we had the story of the fire and the cloud, Egypt was going through a terrible time. Exodus was just not something that was a tussle between Moses and a hard-hearted Pharaoh. It was a global problem because this was a benign flyby, if there's such a thing, of Planet X system. And if you take the 10 plagues of Exodus and reorder it from now the allegorical to the scientific, snaps together like Legos. Now, the Colburn itself is, it's a joy to read. It's a delight to read. It's very laconic. If somebody tells you, I read the Colburn over the weekend, you're going to get Pinocchio'd, so step aside. You don't want to have a nose going through your head. I'm serious. I read the Colburn. I could read two or three passages, and it was so dense with information, I would have to just take a couple of weeks just to contemplate it. And that's the joy of it. People who get it, they love reading it. The man on the street accounts, and it's literally like man on the street. It's not this airy fairy, you know, the princess shot the arrow in the sky, and the hoochie coochie god fell off his perch, whatever, that kind of nonsense. No, this is, they're telling you what it is. And one of the things that they say is, when we see this, and they're telling us, we are going to see it. Now, and for your listeners, if you want to go there, I have some passages up on the site for the Colburn. That's KOLBRIN.com. That's KOLBRIN.com. And what the Egyptians were telling us is, when we see this, men are beginning to become impotent, and women will become infertile because of the fear. And keep in mind, people were very young in those times. Most of the people were still less than 20 years of age, most of them being teenagers. And so you have to stop and think, what are we going to see in the sky that will scare the sex out of a teenager? I'm not making a joke. That's a serious observation. And that's good. What, that is exactly what's going to happen and affect us when this comes. So there's a huge amount of information. And there's a book we published by Greg Jenner called Planet X and the Colburn Bible. It's a small book. It's a one-day read. It takes all the relevant passages from the Colburn that correlate to the passages in the Holy Bible and other wisdom and religious texts. And Jenner just did a brilliant job of it. And if you're looking for, if you're looking for some proof, I call it the cup of tea book. Because after you finish reading it, you're going to know if the Colburn Bible is your cup of tea or not. But then once you start reading the Colburn, you will fall in love with it. There's so, so much wisdom. And the Britain book, where it has tremendous amount of passages about Yeshua, is quite stunning. There's one thing in there that really resonated with me, was that Mary, mother of Jesus, the biographer, she told the biographer, well, my son is doing some very important spiritual work, and this is really nice, but I wish he'd bring home a little more in the way of shekels. That, my friend, is a Jewish mother. Bring home the shekels. So, you know, it's a wonderful book to read. There's a tremendous, the Book of Manuscripts in there, which is written by the Egyptians, has immense amounts of information. There are entire chapters in that book, several chapters, that are devoted solely to the topic of Nibiru, which is called the Destroyer and the Cauldron. And that's what the ancient Hebrews called it, and that's what the ancient Egyptians called it, was the Destroyer. The Celts called it the Frightener. There's a past reference to it in the Celtic side of the Cauldron Bible. And so if you want to read that, what it will do is it'll give you another way of actually, for those of you that really love studying your home Bible, it will give you a different perspective on your own Bible study program. And, of course, you know, do it on your own. If you go into a church or you go into a study group and you mention this, you'll be kicking rocks down the road. So just don't go there. But if you're just someone that says, you know, I can go one-on-one with my God. Yep, that's what I want. I don't need a middleman. I don't need someone holding the door. I'll just do it myself. Well, then that's the book to read. And you will love it. And you'll have to take it in small amounts. For me, it's such an honor as a publisher that I'm publishing the Cauldron, making it available to people, because I'm standing on the shoulders of generations that have sacrificed in silence to preserve this amazing work. And that's exactly what it is. It's an amazing work. So, you know, again, KOLBRIN.com, and go visit the site. I give some information there. There's also a Cauldron video I did on my Yao Books channel on YouTube, and we get into that as well. And I do that was a 10-part series. It gets pretty deep. You know, that is if you really, really want to go into the metaphysical on it. But the Cauldron is, for those that are into Planet X, it's as much a must-read as Zachariah Sitchin's books. And here's an important thing, John, about doing this and reading it and studying it, as opposed to just, you know, people, they'll say, well, I don't know, I don't have time, or I'm not interested, or this or that. And what do? They'll go home and they'll spend 2 hours watching clickbait and not think twice about it, because clickbait is entertaining. And you know it's clickbait, so you don't take it serious. It's like ghost stories, you know? Yeah, you're sitting around the campfire, and the hook was found in the boy and the girl. That's it. Finish your marshmallow. Go to bed. We got to pack out in the morning. And you really have to take your time. You have to study this stuff, because it'll prepare your mind. And preparedness is my whole bag right now, helping people to prepare. And preparedness is not a place, a time, or a person. Preparedness is a state of mind. And a good way to think about it is this. Imagine you go to the bank to take out whatever banking business you're going to do. And that next thing you know, there's a bunch of young thugs with 9mm, and you got one pressed up against the side of your head, and this kid is absolutely shaking like a leaf. And out of the corner of your eye, you look across the street, and there's a SWAT team on the building, and one of their snipers is setting up with a long rifle. Now, you see that guy set up, and he has got this kid in his sights that's got a gun to your head. Now, what's that guy, if he knows what he's doing, what's he aiming for? It's called the apricot, the medulla oblongata. You put a bullet through that, you're dead before you know you're dead. That's it. And so if he gets the order that's clear, take the shot, the guy holding the gun to your head is not even going to know he's dead when he's falling to the ground, because it's just instantaneous, like a light switch. And so you survive. And that's an important thing. So let's talk about that guy with the rifle on the building. Do you want somebody that's sitting there and is cool, calm, collected, prepared, and has been going, you know, going to the range, doing classes, doing drills? This person has been preparing for this for years. Or do you want somebody that's standing on the top of the building and says, my uncle got me this job, and it's really kind of cool, but could somebody tell me the pointy end of the bullet, which way does it go? What would you want, John?
Oh, you know the answer to that one, Marshall.
There you go. So the whole point of it, John, is that if you are preparing, you're contemplating, and serious thought, yes, it can be a depressing top, but you punch through that. You get to have a clinical view of it, no different than an emergency room physician. Emergency room physicians, you know, they see you and they see what they have to do. And they just do it. All right. They don't stand there and go, oh my God, look at all the blood. You know, no, they just get to it. That's what you really want. So what you have to remember is the human brain is this amazing wetware computer. And if we come across a situation we don't know how to process, if we apply ourselves, our brain will create new neural circuitry so that we can process it. That is really important. And that's what contemplation and study will do for you. Where is that going to pan out for you? Contemplation and study, because who in the heck likes to do homework anyway, right? So
right.
Here's where, how many times have you heard, John, when you talk with people about this and they go, well, if it's really that bad, I just want to die on the first day. How many times do you hear that?
Well, I've heard a lot of folks, that's basically the put your head in the sand. That's the ostrich effect. And that's what a lot of people want to do. They don't even want to talk about it. They just want to stick their head in the sand. So, I mean, and I understand what you're saying, Marshall. So,
right.
you brought up a lot of good. I want to say this because we're about, you know, ScaryCast is almost done for this evening. We have covered a lot of great topics. And I appreciate you being here with us. You've opened up a few new doors for me, at least. And I want to speak with you shortly here and see about some additional talks that we can have, kind of like fireside chats here on ScaryCast with Dr. John and Marshall. And so we'll kind of hold this topic over till our next meeting on here. Is that okay?
Sure enough.
Yeah, and I really do appreciate you being on here with us, and I know our listeners do, and we'll be sharing this with everybody. So I want to say thank you so much, Marshall, for joining us for this very special issue of ScaryCast, and we'll have you on soon. Now, coming up on Thursday night at our time of 11 p.m., we will return to VOC Nation for our live show at 11 p.m. Eastern Time on this coming Thursday. And then we will be out with listeners on Spotify and iTunes. So we're getting around, and we got great guests. This Thursday, we've got Jackson Samael from Australia. He and I are going to talk about similarities between the bunyip, which is a creature in Australia that has been sighted many, many times, and my favorite dude, the lizard man, here from or the one that I study is from Lee County, South Carolina, the one that amazed the world between 1988 and 1990. So we've got a lot of great things coming up on ScaryCast. We'll have more Marshall Masters coming up very soon, as soon as we can get into his busy schedule. And Marshall, again, we appreciate it. And your site, what is your website so that everybody knows where to go?
YOWUSA.com or MarshallMasters.com.
Right.
Type in MarshallMasters.com. It'll take you right to your own world.
That's right. Well, look, thanks a lot. Everybody go check it out. Get you a copy of the Colburn Bible. We'll talk more about that very, very soon. This is Dr. John saying thanks again to Marshall Masters. Have a safe trip out there in beautiful beautiful West Coast. I know you've got a lot of exciting things to do, and we look forward to having you. I've heard rumors you're going to be here on the East Coast, and we'll be getting with you to meet up with you. Maybe we can do a scary cast when you come over here. We'll do one live from the middle of your trip. And so there's the British.
Well, that
lady.
Sounds
She's
like a lot of fun.
Yes, British lady saying it's about that time to go. So thanks a lot, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you this coming Thursday night for another issue of ScaryCast.